Understanding psychological warfare and how to resist it. Now, psychological warfare, remember, can be used against us by the enemy. We can also use it against the enemy. So psychological warfare in some ways is neutral because you can't. It's like the jungle is neutral. It can be a strength for the enemy. It can be a strength for your side. We need to know how to use it. The goal of psychological warfare is to undermine an enemy's will to resist and, of course, to strengthen your own people's will to resist. Psychological warfare involves tactics intended to manipulate your opponents or your enemies, manipulate or intimidate them. This includes the dissemination of propaganda and disinformation. Of course, it could be the dissemination of truth if you're using it against the enemies. The goal of psychological warfare is to undermine the morale of enemy forces and erode their will or their ability to resist. Now, in the military, terms like psy war or psychological warfare or psyop, psychological operations, are also known as winning hearts and minds, and political warfare and propaganda in South Africa, which is called communications operations or comhops. And normally, military intelligence distinguishes between psyop's own forces or comhop's own forces, where you build up the morale of your side, PSYOP's enemy forces or COMOP's enemy forces in South Africa to break down the morale of both enemy soldiers and their civilian supporting population. And then you have PSYOP's local population or COMOP's LPs in South African term to win over the hearts and minds of those in the operation area, the neutrals, the POVO, the people in the middle. The main goal of PSYOP's is aimed at emotions and values. PSYOPs recognize that they need to target their audience's belief system, their value system, their emotions, their motives, their reasoning, and their behavior. Now, in the Soviet Union, they would use the Commissar to build up the morale of their side. They might use the KGB or the NKVD to break down the morale of everyone else. Now, just look at an example of PSYOPs in a Muslim newspaper. Young boy sleeping with his parents in Syria. That looks pretty emotionally gut-wrenching. Until you realize there's no graves there. Those are just empty mounds of stones, and this is a photo op. This kid's been paid to tug on people's emotions so that they can raise a whole lot of money for this terrorist group that's trying to tear Syria apart, claiming that this kid is a victim of government tyranny, in fact, more like the ISIS or Al-Qaeda or some of these other groups that were founded by the CIA. But this is a complete and utter tug at the heartstrings fake news story. Now, some countries have resorted to false flags or black ops to discredit the enemy forces by terrorist operations which can be attributed to the enemy. So there's a whole lot of examples, like the anthrax attack on Washington, D.C. was done by the American government to psych up people and to panic them into accepting all the extra rules they bring in post 9/11. American war with Vietnam began with this totally fake story. I know people who were in the US Navy at that very place. They said there was nothing out there. But according to the official reports, the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which catapulted America into the Vietnam War, was three torpedo boats, Vietnamese torpedo boats, must be some of the bravest torpedo boat operators in history, attacking an American battle fleet with an aircraft carrier, destroyers, battleships. Can you imagine three torpedo boats going out and attacking a battle fleet? And if you can believe that, well, they've got some beachfront property to sell you. Anyway, that was the Gulf of Tonkin incident that led LBJ to launch over 650,000 Americans into Vietnam. It was a massive operation, cost hundreds of millions and made some people super rich, killed a lot of people too, of course, and it was all built on a false flag, where they claimed their battle fleet was attacked by some torpedo boats of the North Vietnamese. Then you've got the noble lie, which is the Oklahoma City bombing, where the evidence is huge that it was an own goal. The US government did it to themselves in order to panic people. Interesting, on the fifth anniversary of the massacre of the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas, the 80th for the American Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms branch of the FBI got a bombing attack in Waco, Texas. It just so happened no ATF or FBI people were there that day, None of the children were in the creche as part of the building. It killed a lot of people, but funny enough, the targets weren't there that day. Isn't that strange? But it gets more strange than that. And we've got the film, the documentary, A Noble Lie, on how the Clinton government organized this to get rid of the evidence just before Congress was going to subpoena all the evidence of the massacring of the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. And where those records were kept just happened to be in a building where they had this own goal bombing, the worst terrorist attack in America to that date, eclipsed later by 9/11, but an own goal. This is a false flag. And then Antonin Galitzin, one of the top defectors from the Soviet Union, had predicted the whole glasnost, perestroika, Gorbachev, charm offensive, which turned out to have been a deception operation that went out of control, because a lot of people in the Soviet Union and the satellite states said, yay, freedom, and they acted like it was real, and they took it further than it ever was meant to go, but perestroika and glasnost was just meant to get more Western investment and put people to sleep in the West. They didn't think it would. It just shows sometimes your deception operations can go too far and people can take it too seriously. But there's also the assault on the Liberty. An American ship, the Liberty, was attacked by the Israelis in unmarked planes at the beginning of the Six-Day War, and LBJ was about to launch American nuclear attack on Egypt, and the planes were in the air and all of that, because they were going to blame this attack, which is a false flag operation, on the Egyptians to bring American on the side of the State of Israel to bomb Egypt, who was a major ally of the Soviet Union at that stage. And anyway, the assault on Liberty went wrong because the people refused to die. Most of the ship was destroyed, and yet it was not totally knocked out of fight. And the whole thing is just one of many false flag operations. We've got a newsletter on false flag operations, and that's interesting. The chemical attacks that the Syrian government's meant to have done against their own population several times has been proved to be fake and used with NATO gas provided by Turkey, a total false flag operations. And these are just a few, just a handful of examples. The amount of false flags being done, I don't know if anyone's heard of Operation Gladio, one of the more insane operations organized by the CIA back in the 1950s. They organized communist terrorist groups in Europe to assassinate presidents, murder people, bombings, massacres, all kinds of things all over. They toppled governments in Italy. They did all sorts of things, all to blame on the communists, to get people stampeded into NATO's agenda and to be willing to accept loss of their own freedoms for their safety and things like this. So Operation Gladio was a CIA op. And there's been others, Operation Mockingbird. You can go through a whole range of, or Operation Ajax, toppling of governments in Egypt, in Iran, in order to blame it on the communists, even though it was being done by the capitalists to protect the oil companies' investments. So false flags or black ops, terrorist attacks done by people on their own side to blame the enemy and to stampede your people to, you know, for protection, come to us and we'll protect you. But our guys sometimes organize the terrorism. Now, of course, psychological warfare is no longer limited to soldiers. Targets of psyops now include civilians, groups, churches, organizations, governments, even missions. And we can give examples of missions that have been targeted by Christian broadcasting agencies, Christian newspaper and magazine groups, because media technology can target the population. Take this as an example. In 60 seconds, every 60 seconds, there are 1,600 reads on Scribd, 11,000 hours of music listened to, streamed on Pandora, 12,000 new ads posted on Craigslist, 370,000 minutes of voice calls on Skype. That's every 60 seconds. There are another 98,000 tweets, probably more now, another 320 new Twitter accounts. This is in 60 seconds, just a minute. 100 new LinkedIn accounts. And then there's articles being published, a new article being published every 60 seconds. And then 6,600 new articles on Flickr, 50 WordPress downloads, 125 plugin downloads, and then you can carry on. There's 695,000 Facebook status updates every 60 seconds, 79,000 wall posts, 510,000 comments, that's 500,000 comments every 60 seconds on Facebook. 1,700 Firefox downloads. What's Firefox?
It's an independent browser that you can use
instead of Google. Okay, if that sounds bizarre, Google. 695,000 search queries every minute. 168 million emails sent every minute. 60 new blogs, 1,500 new blog posts, 70 domains registered. You can think 600 new videos on YouTube every minute. I mean, can you imagine the opportunities? And of course, some of this will be good, some of this will be bad, some of this will be ugly, some of it will be indifferent. It's not all bad. It's certainly not all good, but this can be used for good or this could be used for bad. It's the content that makes a difference. Questions asked on the internet, over 100 and so on. And then you've got 13,000 iPhone applications downloaded and 20,000 new posts on Tumblr. I haven't really heard of Tumblr much. What do they do?
It's a messaging platform that's very, very short, specific messages with a lot of subjects.
Okay. So, and then just think of all these different things going on every single minute on the internet. And so people are being more and more influenced, not by the newspaper headlines. I feel sorry for the people at Traffic Lights trying to sell newspapers in Cape Town these days. Nobody's really reading them. Newspapers are a thing of the past. And to be honest, that's not a bad thing. This has taken the news out of the hands of the billionaires who controlled the newspapers and made available to housewives, students, people all over the world can now have input in the media because of the internet. Technology and media are increasingly being used to affect political changes desired by the enemy or revolutionary forces. Can you think of any revolutions sparked by the internet? The Arab Spring. They toppled the government of Egypt. They toppled the government of Libya with cell phones. Also in Tunisia, that was all part of the Arab Spring. Started a war, a massive destructive civil war in Syria, done by the internet. I mean, these are internet-driven revolutions.
Black Lives Matter is also...
That's true. Black Lives Matter is another example of something that was just triggered by the internet. Now, remember this first picture of a policeman kneeling on the shoulders of a man and, you know, thinking, this looks disgusting, but of course I hadn't heard the whole story yet. That's exactly how they train them to operate. And it's not anything like how the Chinese kneel on with a truncheon under the throat of the Hong Kong protesters and so on. And this man was already into shock because of drug overdose. And he also had another condition too. When you know the whole story and that this is a criminal with a long track record, it's not as exciting as the way the media first put it. But initially, you know, we were all shocked by the images which were shown over and over. And then they showed video clips, but they'd edited out key parts of the video clips, such as the man saying, I can't breathe, before he was put on the ground. And he was going into shock beforehand. But he's attacking the police, and he's a massive man, very much bigger than the policeman. They did exactly what they were trained to do, and by the book. But nevertheless, the policeman responsible is in jail today, and he's been stabbed in jail multiple times. A policeman in jail is a target. But a person's life ruined because the media portrayal, which included massive censorship. And anyway, interesting how the police had been using all their force to crack down on people who are protesting about masks and mandatory vaccinations and all of that and lockdowns. But the police were told to stand back even while the BLM mobs burned down shopping centers and a police station in Minneapolis. Two-tiered policing all over the place. Now, through fake news and peer pressure, people are taught to self-censor, to avoid expressing views that could get you unfriended, blocked, shadow banned, or deplatformed. I mean, just think, for example, when we were sharing things about the lockdown lunacy, the masquerade madness, or the mandatory COVID salvation by vaccination COVID cult, and you put anything on that, you got immediately your post was blocked. I posted some things that had, within seconds of me uploading it, was, you know, blanked out and, you know, fake news. How could they know it's fake news? They haven't done the research. They weren't there. They weren't here. They didn't see what we saw. They weren't in that march to Parliament and so on. And, you know, this fake news, it's not that they were concerned about fake news. They're afraid of the truth. You didn't start to get fact checkers until the truth started getting out. Now, remember, you can win wars through media manipulation. Classic example, Vietnam. The Vietnamese commander famously declared, Vietnam did not win the war against America on the battlefield. They won on the campuses and in the living rooms in the United States of America through the television coverage of the American protests against the war. And by the way, that's got another story too that goes with it. Anyone here heard of Charles Manson and the murders in what was 1968 in Los Angeles? Well, there's a new book out called Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and a Secret History of the 60s. Now, because of the hippie movement and the hell no, we won't go, the hey ho, LBJ, how many kids have you killed today? And all of this hippie movement, make love, not war, and all this, they were undermining the whole ethos of America. So the CIA got an asset, and Charles Manson was one of the assets. According to this new Chaos book that's out there, which is 20 years of research, a phenomenal amount of research, this author of Chaos, Charles Manson, the CIA, and the Secret History of the 60s, the CIA worked out how to kill the hippie movement. They had a man pose as a hippie. Well, actually, he was a hippie. He was a career criminal. He had such a long rap sheet, longer than his arm, Charles Manson, who was in incarceration more than he is out. And they got him out on bail when he shouldn't have been and had him train a bunch of hippies to be mass murderers using the MKUltra drug manipulation to get people to do assassinations who are, you know, that normally be peaceful people. And so got these hippies under Charles Manson in his cult to discredit the whole hippie movement. And it killed the 60s hippie movement. It died with the Charles Manson murder trial, where it so shocked the population of America around the world that that was the end of the hippies. That was the end of this make love, not war, and all this other stuff that was undermining the whole war industry in America. But yes, Vietnam won the war on the television screens on the campuses in the United States of America. And the hippie movement played a big role in it. And so the CIA hit back to destroy the hippie movement by discrediting them. So people were sick of the hippie movement when they saw the Charles Manson murders on people like Sharon Tate and so on. Well, think of Rhodesia. Rhodesia was never beaten. We were betrayed. The Prime Minister of Rhodesia, Ian Smith, who's been a guest in this Livingston House, and I've interviewed him on radio, and he famously declared on Radio Tigerberg in one of our programs, we were never beaten by our enemies, we were betrayed by our friends. And his book, which you've got here, The Great Betrayal, documents that very fact. We were betrayed by our friends, and in many cases it was undermining from within. Because when he's talking about betrayed, he's not just talking about betrayal by the US State Department and the British Foreign Office. That was part of it. It was betrayal by the Southern governments and the National Party, the Bourbons, and it was even betrayal by some of the people within his own government. Do you know that Rhodesia's head of the CIO, Central Intelligence Organization, who is Ken Flower, we've got his book here as well. Ken Flower was working for the British MI6. Ian Smith, when he got his book, when it came out, he read it and he said, this confirms to me that my head of security, Ken Flower, running Rhodesian Central Intelligence Organization, was working for the enemy. And the British, who had Ken Flower in their pocket, used information that he passed on to them to undermine Rhodesia's key operations, like the cross-border raid in Zambia to get Joshua Nkomo off his people, shot down the Viscounts and killed the survivors and ate some of them too. The SAS and the Sulu scouts made a raid across the border, and when they got to the house, Joshua Nkomo was gone. And how was he gone? Well, the British MI6 tipped them off. Same thing happened when the Rhodesians were going in to destroy old Robert Mugabe in Mozambique after a whole lot of atrocities, including murdering the missionaries at Elim, British missionaries, mind you. But the British betrayed the Rhodesian operation so that Robert Mugabe survived. So we were betrayed from within Rhodesia's security forces as well. Traitors like Ken Flower. I mean, imagine the head of your security, just like Britain's head of security during the James Bond years, 1950s and 60s, was a KGB agent. So Sir Roger Hollis was actually working for the KGB, and that came out. Here's the fifth man of the Cambridge Five. And betrayal. You have no idea how, I mean, that changes history. Certainly changes the movies. Now imagine if every James Bond film you saw, M is actually a KGB agent. Doesn't that sort of ruin a lot of the scenario? And but that's a reality. Our President P.W. Botha of South Africa tried to warn the South African population of the total war that was targeting every aspect of life in South Africa. And the mass media derided this, but history has proven President P.W. Botha was absolutely correct. It was total war. South Africa was subjected to a total war where our South African Defence Force was spectacularly successful on the battlefield on the border of Southwest Africa, what today is Namibia, in the preemptive strikes into the communist-controlled Angola. Yes, we won every battle, even against the elite of the Soviet Union, the top of the Cuban forces. And of course, we were undermined by subversion, sedition, sabotage, bombings, such as of this bar here in Durban Beach, on university campuses, in classrooms, in the media, on the streets. Insidious sedition subverted the public. When I came down from Rhodesia to South Africa, it was so clear. Newspapers were almost daily, you know, the picture on the Rand of Jan van Riebeek. That's not the picture of Jan van Riebeek. That's somebody else. Jan van Riebeek wasn't a hero. He was punished by being sent to the Cape. And you know, the VOC, the way they changed it, they turned the father of the nation into a person who was somehow suspected of embezzlement and things like this, which is not true. There's no foundation to these accusations, but they make you distrust every aspect of your history, anybody that was important. And even in my classroom, I remember in Pilots High School, the history teacher would be always undermining South Africa, always undermining our government, our army, our police. And there was just so much anti undermining. And you got it everywhere in the country. Our commander of Simonstown, Dieter Gerhardt, turned out to be an East German secret agent. He is a Stasi agent. So Simonstown military base, which is the most important naval base in the Southern Hemisphere, on the West NATO side, was being run by a communist agent of East Germany. And Dieter Gerhardt was arrested in 1982. His wife was also part of the conspiracy. But of course, they were released in 1994 and turned into folk heroes at that point. I think they've named some things after me. He's now some hero of the Navy. And although the ANC could be justly described, as Margaret Thatcher said, the most spectacularly unsuccessful revolutionary movement in the world, they were very unsuccessful. About the only success there is what was done by the Soviets or the East Germans, but the ANC had no successes to their name. Not one single victory to their name in over 30 years of armed struggle. But the allies in the Southern Council of Churches were also super busy subverting the country. From pulpits, you would get messages that were undermining our defense against Soviet communism. In the universities and the editors of many newspapers, which include people like Donald Wood in East London with his ridiculous fake story in Cry of Freedom, which ended up as a major film. Hollywood, sports boycotts. We couldn't play rugby, cricket, football, anything overseas. We couldn't even take part in the Paralympics. Olympics. There was all kinds of disinvestment campaigns, sanctions, general psychological warfare, economic warfare, political warfare, all waged by the Soviet bloc. This is total warfare, everything, economics, entertainment, all the way through the schools, the media, every aspect was a total war. It was directed against us. The European Economic Community, what today is the EU, the Organization of African Unity, what today is the African Union, the British Foreign Office, the US State Department, and the United Nations all combined to fight South Africa. And I should have added the International Olympic Committee. All of them were combined in attacking South Africa. Wore us down, or much of the population, to where much of the population was willing to settle for a negotiated settlement with a defeated ANC. Think, 1989, we had just defeated the Soviet offensive in Cuba, in Angola. The Cubans were defeated. The whole Lomba River area, Cuitcanaval, you can still see from satellites the graveyard of Soviet tanks. You can see who won the Cold War. We had won the war. And the Soviet Union had collapsed, and the Berlin Wall had collapsed, and the Iron Curtain had collapsed. And the sponsors of the ANC and SWAPO were retreating. The Cubans were getting on their ships, going back to Cuba. The Soviets were pulling out the aid. They were bankrupt. At this point, the ANC was finished. National Party resuscitated him. And when I say they, I exclude myself because I'm one of the 650,000 South Africans who voted no in the referendum of 1992, and I did not support this one bit, but enough South Africans were stupid enough to support this in 1992 and give a blank check to the National Party, who were betraying us, obviously. Well, in exchange, what did we get for selling out our country? Well, we got international sports, cricket, rugby overseas, and we could participate in the Barcelona Olympics in 1992. Notice, while the South African team's there, we couldn't march under our South African flag. We had to march under a white flag, which is appropriate, with the Olympic signals under it. So we got to march at the Olympics in Barcelona, got a few medals, and of course, we won the World Cup in 1995. So we won ball games, but we lost our country, or betrayed our country, I should say. And here you can see the white flag in front, and here's our Springbok team at last able to represent the country overseas. But I think they called them the Proteas. They weren't allowed to be called the Springboks. Now, this is something of a carrot and stick approach. There are threats and there are temptations. So, do you want the stick or do you want the carrot? Here's a carrot, carrot, stick, carrot, stick. And so the sticks are economic sanctions, disinvestment, boycotts, bans, riots, sabotage, bombings, sporadic acts of terrorism at home, and increasing condemnation from abroad, and of course from our churches too. So when this is going on, it's extraordinary South Africa put up with this for decades. You know, we had a resilient, tough population, and many of us were willing and are willing to have continued the war for the last 30 years too, if necessary. But there were others who were getting weary of it and a temptation. What did you say, Olympics? We can play rugby in Australia. We can play cricket in New Zealand. Goody, goody. Okay, who cares about the country, our children, our grandchildren, the future? Let's just hand everything over to a bunch of terrorists. Put them in charge of police. What could possibly go wrong? Put them in charge of army. What could possibly go wrong? And put them in charge of schools and the economy. How could that ever turn out bad? And then what? Are you telling me that the police commissioner is actually a gangster and guilty of all kinds of crimes? And it's not just one, it's like every one of them, of the police commissioners, have turned out to be involved in gangsterism and crime, and it's an absolute disgrace. Our first one, what was it, Celebi? He was chairman of Interpol at the time, and then finds out that actually he's a gangster and a criminal, working with the criminals all along. And some people were surprised, but I said, you can't put a police uniform on a terrorist and expect him suddenly to be a paragon of law and order. So the carrots were the opportunity. The biggest one was participation in the international Barcelona Olympics 1992. And, what a fraud that was. We couldn't even march under our own flag. But yeah, you can see there's carrots and there's sticks. Psy war is basically a battle for the mind. If you don't control your mind, somebody else will. In psyops, propagandists target the adversaries by seeking to destroy, by psychological means, the morale and confidence of their targeted opponent, to the extent that they begin to doubt the validity of their beliefs, their values, and actions. I had so many people in the army, I was warning the guys back in 1988, 1989, National Party's betraying us. Look what they're doing. They've betrayed Rhodesia. They betrayed Renama. They're betraying Savimbi's UNITA now. They're going to betray 3-2 Battalion, the Bushman's Battalion. And I remember some of these smug sergeant majors and colonels saying, no, if W won't betray us, the National Party's got a trick up their sleeve. Like, really? And some of them, they've got something up their sleeve. Well, maybe armpits, but I don't see anything else up their sleeve that they're talking about. But this is the thing. We had all these South Africans trusting the National Party, but my great-grandfather voted for the National Party. Yeah, so you think they're still trustworthy today. Look at what the clerk's doing. Now, hear from Yuri Bezmenov. He's a KGB agent who defected in 1984. Now, 1984 is a long time ago. Here he outlines the stages of operation for ideological subversion. And you can see these four stages of ideological subversion. I saw it in South Africa. You can see it in Britain. You can see it in America right now, Germany, France as well. First stage, demoralization. Educate an entire generation in Marxist ideology. The ideology of the classroom in this generation will be the ideology of government in the next generation. Destabilization. Destabilize the economy and destabilize foreign relations. Destabilize the defense system. Sanctions on South Africa's defense industry. Economic relations subverted in every way. Our economy was subverted. all the boycotts, all the riots, we had 5 million young people in this country who got no education. No education before liberation. And while Desmond Tutu was chanting that, his children were being trained in private schools in Atlanta, Georgia. And Alan Busack did the same thing. All hypocrites. No education before liberation. Our children go overseas to private schools. Your kids must stay out of the schools. And then there's a crisis. Some violent change of power, change of structure, change the economy, changing names of streets and towns or whatever. Just crisis. And then suddenly there'll be normalization. After all the crisis, and get everyone worked up about this and bombings here and landmines and riots, suddenly there's a period of normalization. It's like a hammer. You draw the hammer back to bring the hammer down. Now, it's part of the same action. You've got to pull the hammer back. You could say release in order to bring it down. And so you'd every now and then have detente, peaceful coexistence, glasnost, perestroika, whatever. And that's the withdrawal, bringing the hammer back. And then suddenly the hammer comes down. And so you've got this continual, the communists call it two steps forward, one step back. Two steps forward, one step back. You take two steps forward, but you don't want to wake the people up. If the people look a bit shocked, take a step back. Oh, everything's okay, let's go back to sleep, and so on. And so this is how it operates. Yuri Bezmenov says, the highest art in warfare is not to fight at all, but to subvert everything of value in the country of the enemy, until such time that the perception of reality of the enemy is screwed up to such an extent, so undermined, that he doesn't perceive you as an enemy. And you just think how good Nelson Mandela was at that. He was, you know, kill a Boer, kill a farmer, and so on. And then he brilliantly, probably the cleverest thing he ever did, put on a green Springbok cap, put on a green Springbok jersey, identified with the Springboks in the moment of greatest triumph, while a billion people worldwide were watching, and every South African. And suddenly it's like hardcore National Party people are speaking about Uam Nelson. And I mean, the whole outlook, he won over the nation by the token act of identifying with the Springbok rugby team and advocating to keep the name of the Springboks, which his party wants to change. And with that, how brilliant was that? And meanwhile, kicking out Afrikaners from every position possible in the army, kicking them out of the police, kicking them out of schools, colleges, changing the whole economy, destroying our civil service, destroying our economy, organizing the uni-cities, which would basically loot the productive in order to be a cover for massive corruption. And I mean, how many billions did they steal? And this is a man who died with hundreds of millions in the bank, his personal wealth. How do you get that when the only work you'd done was being president for 5 years, which is a salary of about 200,000 rand a month, a year, I mean, 200,000 a year? How did he make hundreds of millions in 5 years of being president? As Truman in America once said, you can only get rich in politics if you're a crook. Well, you can see, they say it takes about a generation, about 15 to 20 years, to demoralize a society. You attack the ideas, you attack the structures, you attack people's lives, society, health, population, labor. But you see how it starts. You politicize and commercialize and get into entertainment of the whole, how are we doing it? What happened? Vaughn, do you know what our problem is with this connection? On each side, you can see you go from the ideas to getting people into a death wish and ignorance. You can see our education is pushing permissiveness and relativity, and you can see the results of an ignorant graduate. As I say, some students are so ignorant they can't even read their diplomas. In fact, they've done a study in America that the longer you're in high school in America, the stupider you get. The children learn things in primary school, but once they get to high school, they start to go backwards. And that basically, the longer the child is in high school, the stupider they are. And now today, some of the dumbest people in our population are university graduates. And it's not accidental. It's not a failure of education. That's their goal. Dumb down the population by dumbing down the education. And now a lot of what they call education is just indoctrination. But you can see how you ignore morals in law and order, you make it more legislative. And in the end, people mistrust the justice. you can see such a disproportion. The amount of harsh punishment on a person who's peacefully protesting on a matter of ideas and principle, he gets a book thrown at him, gets thrown to jail. They've frog-marched 11-year-old girls to prison in Britain. They've frog-marched old men in the 80s to prison in Britain for a Facebook post. And yet people who are throwing bombs and missiles and walking around armed to the teeth in Britain, they've just told by the police, please hide your weapons. And so the British police, who would arrest you if you had some weapon like a knife or something visible, they can have these Muslims in Britain with axes and swords and zip guns and all sorts of weapons, firebombs. And the police just asked them, please hide your weapons in the mosque. And, you know, this is bad for PR. And so the police are actively working on the side of some causes and groups and actively against others. Pastors can get arrested in Britain. Preachers can get arrested in Britain for saying something that's a direct quote from the Bible or making an obvious statement like there's only two genders or marriage can only be between a man and a woman. And next thing, that man's in prison and you've got other people out there who are saying, you know, from the river to the sea, exterminate all Jews, wipe out Israel, you know, kill all Englishmen, things like this, you know, rape the girls. That's fine. Those chaps might get a slap on the wrist, but unlikely, they'll probably just be cheered by the police. And am I overstating it? JP, you spend a lot of time in Britain.
No, it's totally a one-sided type of police.
Yeah, I mean, it's two-tiered policing. It's been going on for a long time. You can blame Keir Starmer, as Elon Musk said, two-tier Keir, but it started long before, I'd say, Theresa May. It started under her, basically, at least. Certainly was entrenched in the last several governments. But this is what demoralization looks like, and it's planned. Just take the Rotherham abuse scandal. Have you heard of this? Muslim men were found to have exploited English girls as young as 11 years old in sex gangs. It's a campaign of rape and abuse in the Child Protection Services in Britain. So it was so censored for years. In fact, they worked out that 1 million children in Britain were abused for over 20 years, especially in the children's homes and child protection services, and Scotland Yard refused to investigate because they didn't want to be accused of being racist. And literally, conspiracy of silence on UK sex gangs, and most of the convicted offenders of Pakistani heritage. They don't want to say Muslim, let's just say Pakistani, or then they spoke about Asian rape gangs. And guilty of grooming white girls of 13 for sex, a nation's shame. And then these sex beasts, Asian sex monsters, not a word about Islam. Gangs targeted white girls. And this is such a scandal. And it found out if everywhere from Newcastle through Oxford and Bristol, this is all over the country. Horrific betrayal of, in one case, 1,400 children, new arrests made. And they found these paedophile rapists had 20,000 victims just in 2017 to 2018. And these are just pictures of convicted paedophiles, not accused, convicted from the grooming gangs. But they got away with this for decades because they were Asian, they were Muslim, and therefore the Child Protection Services refused to investigate. Scotland Yard refused to investigate because they didn't want to be accused of being racist. And this is in many places, not just Rotherham. Rotherham got a lot of attention, but Canterbury, Coventry, Oxford, Newcastle, Bristol, Leeds, I mean, really. Grooming gang review kept secret as the Home Office claims releasing the findings is not in the public interest. The voters and the ratepayers and taxpayers should not know what's actually going on. The Labour government that's now in power in Britain will never say a word against the gangs that rape our children. They need the votes. Apparently, that depends on the votes of the very people doing the raping. So Labour Party is a disgusting, despicable bunch of scum. And this 16-year-old girl was stabbed to death on a school bus in Britain. When I went to Britain, I was amazed to see they had in school shops, you know, they've got school uniforms in Britain, stab-proof vests. Stab-proof vests for school uniforms being offered. I mean, they're pretty expensive, you know, and in pounds. Pounds is very expensive. These are the three little girls who were stabbed to death recently that's led to this outrage throughout Britain. I mean, why should they be outraged that their little girls are being stabbed at some Taylor Swift concert? And the person who did this, the government has hidden his identity So the people assumed that the person who stabbed these little girls, and a whole lot of others too, who were badly injured but not killed, must have been a Muslim. And then the government says, no, he's not a Muslim, he's British. Turned out that he's a Rwandan, and there's no evidence that he wasn't a Muslim. He probably was a Muslim. But he's Rwandan of immigrant parents, so he's actually English. He's not one of the immigrants. He's the children of one of the immigrants. But he went to British school, so he's British, right? But there's people out there outraged because these three girls were stabbed to death just recently, and the government lied to them about what had happened and who had done it. And even now they're hiding the identity of the person to such an extent that one's not sure. But there's 10% of Rwandans are Muslim, and it's a strong possibility a lot of immigrants even become Muslim in Britain because the Muslims have tremendous amounts of power there. Now, you can have the Palestinian protests, that's okay. And the police don't seem to do much against them. The BLM people weren't even faced with riot shields and helmets. They had these police in their normal gear. And you can see online a lot of examples of the police fleeing from riotous Muslim mobs, whereas they come in hard and hit the English people when they protest. And Britain's been burning. So you go from undermining to destabilization, and you always need a crisis. The crisis could be something like when we had Chris Hani assassinated in South Africa. Remember 1993, just before Easter, most people were more concerned about Chris Hani than about Christ when it came to Easter in 1993, because the head of the Southern Communist Party gets assassinated. It was another false flag, according to people like General Holomisa and Winnie Mandela. They claimed it was an ANC inside job. They wanted to get rid of Chris Hani. Chris Hani was eloquent and he was charismatic. In fact, he is a far more charismatic person than Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela could be pretty affable and friendly and charismatic. I mean, I heard Nelson Mandela and met with him. But Chris Hani, I've debated with him too, and he's a very smooth, polished speaker. The assassination of Chris Hani removed the obstacle, because Chris Hani would have certainly been Mandela's deputy president and then president afterwards. But Mbeki and Zuma and Ramaphosa benefited greatly by getting this highly popular, very capable, intelligent leader of the Communist Party out of the way. And so Chris Hani was assassinated without doubt by collusion with his own side. And people like General Holomisa and Winnie Mandela stated that his bodyguard was removed on that day. He always had a bodyguard around him, but not on that day. And of course, this Polish man ends up in jail responsible for it. He might have been the one who pulled the trigger, but he was set up almost certainly for this. And it was the ANC's wish that Chris Hani gets assassinated. So you have a crisis. Remember, all over the country, things were burning. I remember after Chris Hani was assassinated, going downtown Cape Town, 100 shops were looted in Adderley Street. We had smashed windows. Adderley Street looked like a war zone. I mean, just out of nowhere, a crisis occurred and a trigger fighting. I mean, remember what's happened in America and George Floyd, and next thing the whole country's burning and people are going berserk in the street. Just spread by social media in that case. In this case, just newspapers, radio and TV. Then after the crisis, you'll have normalization to put people back to sleep. Maybe they're overextended. Now they want to calm people down. Look, now they took 2 steps forward, but they've taken 1 step back. And then after that, you've got to see there's always unprecedented mass communication media opportunities to manipulate emotions. Just think of the picture of, for example, that drowned child on the shore. Now, actually, it was Turkey. It wasn't Greece, but that didn't matter. And they used this to justify that the governments of Europe mobilized their navies to help these illegal immigrants, Muslim invaders, come into their country. Instead of protecting their shores and their boundaries, the navies were triggered by these newspaper pictures of a drowned Syrian child. Not that he's from Syria, but that doesn't matter. Don't ruin a good story with the facts. And, okay, it was on Turkey's shores, not Greece, but, you know, you don't need to bring that fact in either. That sort of ruins the narrative. But how do you control a nation? You distract them, you deceive them, and you divide them. And modern mass communication techniques have allowed unprecedented opportunities for foreign forces to engage in direct communication with a targeted enemy population. And so, whether it was Time magazine, Newsweek, and so on, influencing the way South Africans thought during our 1980s, or whether it is CNN trying to influence people in Britain or in America. In recent times, the internet allows for campaigns of disinformation and misinformation. I just can't believe how much garbage I get on my computer screen when I'm just trying to find something else. And continually, you know, do you have Alzheimer's? You know, are you over 50? Don't miss these things. You know, could you have prostate cancer? And just endlessly, they're trying to bombard you with panic, panic, panic. I must run to the nearest clinic, have these tests and get chemo and all the rest of it. And they're wanting to panic you continually. Remember, driving down Cape Town, every lamppost said, are you over 55? Stay home. And the people who made those rules, how old are they? Why doesn't Ramaphosa stay home? And they were just continually trying to attack us and get us into negative and panic mode. And this includes false flags and agent provocateurs to seek to discredit the targeted group. There's so many crying wolves. There's an excellent expert on how all the hate crimes are hoaxes in America. So virtually every time you get a synagogue painted up with swastikas, it turns out the synagogue's own members did it, or the rabbi himself did the painting of the swastikas on the wall, or desecrated Jewish cemetery, almost always done by the local synagogue and by the rabbi. And same thing with anti-Islamic things, hate crimes against Muslims, normally done by the sheikh, the mahullah, or the imam, and on and on. You have some of these black American politicians who are victims of a hate crime. It turns out it never happened, and you get photographic evidence. These guys sometimes did the hate crimes to themselves in order to get some media publicity. The amount of hate crime hoaxes. And then when you hear, you know, one of your people did this or that, probably fake, but it's often so convenient when it happens. You can do almost anything in this world. You can nuke people. You can throw phosphorus bombs on them. You can shoot them in the head. That's not a problem. But the moment you use gas or chemicals, that's like strength forbidden. Can't even think about that. That's beyond the... And so when Syria was winning the war, and they've won battles, next thing you know, the Syrian government's accused of using chemical warfare against their own people. And the result is we've got to send cruise missiles into their cities to kill more of their people, because what's a better way of showing people you shouldn't kill your own people? Kill more of them. And you use sarin gas, but we're going to use cruise missiles. And so whenever the Muslim terrorist rebels were losing in Syria, there'd be some kind of chemical attack that the stupidest thing the Syrian government could have done. And it turned out, no, they didn't do it. They weren't that stupid. The sarin gases and the chemical warfare, it was always done by NATO against Syria to blame on the Syrian government. And it's been proven, hoax, 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 lies, 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 over and over, primetime propaganda. And then they also try to character assassinate those whom they target. When you get somebody who is really effective, next thing you find there's all kind of sex scandals, and you know, you just look, when Donald Trump was winning, what did they do? They suddenly trot out someone who says, I can't remember when or where, but you know, Donald Trump groped me or said this to me or something back 30, 40 something years ago. I never mentioned it to anyone before now, but you know, now it's a problem because he suddenly advanced in the polls. And this is so predictable. They character assassinate anyone they want to target. Has anyone here heard of the Frankfurt School of Marxism? Okay, a few. The Frankfurt School of Cultural Marxism recognized that while World War I and the military defeat of the Tsarist Russians provided a unique opportunity for the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. Violent revolution was unlikely to succeed anywhere in Western Europe. Lenin got lucky. We're not likely to get that correlation of force again. And so Marxist leaders like Antonio Gramsci, the founder of the Communist Party of Italy, proposed the termite strategy, which we today call a Gramsci strategy, to erode from the inside the cultural institutions of the West. So Gramsci said, the West is too Christian. We've got to de-Christianize the West. We've got to turn the West from a Christian mind to a non-Christian mind to an anti-Christian mind before we can hope to take over the West. Just like a termite can hollow out the inside of a wooden building. I mean, imagine if we've got termites eating away through the wooden beams here. After a while, you could slap extra white paint over it or whitewash it. It wouldn't change the fact that ultimately the whole structure would crumble. I think you've got to have, what, Beatles certificates before any house is sold and so on. You can't allow these wood-eating termites like beetles into a wooden structure, or it is doomed. And so He is saying we've got to be like those termites, eating out the structures of Western civilization from the inside. And so Marxists need to work for slow, gradual, long-term, culminative revolution through infiltrating the five cultural institutions of the West. The culture-carrying, culture-transforming institutions of Western society is, number one, educational institutions. That's like the thumb. Rot them out. And of course, what are the five pillars of liberal faith? Hysteria, denial of reality, thought control, name-calling, and projection of guilt. Whatever they're guilty of, they accuse you of. And that's what our educational institutions are built on these days. Just go up the hill to Sodom on the hillside, and you can see what University of Communist Terrorism comes out with. And next is news media. All the news that's fit to print without fear or favor, remember? Yeah? But actually, it's the manufacturing of consent. All right people, all right-thinking people agree. All scientists agree. All doctors agree. Follow the science. Trust the science. But then suddenly you get South Africa's top heart transplant specialist, Dr. Susan Fosloo, who's also the head of communication diseases at Kruger, and she says, you're more in danger of the COVID vaccine than you are of COVID itself. And next thing is, what does Susan Fosloo know? She's an idiot. She's a moron. She should be stripped of her credentials. She should never be allowed to practice medicine again. And they went absolutely berserk in the media because, well, these are the people saying, trust the science. But the moment the scientist speaks in it, and a scientist whose knowledge field is particularly hot, and, you know, she's a moron, she's an idiot, what does she know? She shouldn't even be allowed to practice medicine. So it's easy to say all the experts agree when you deplatform and fire and dismiss anyone who's a scientist who disagrees from you, well, they're no longer allowed to practice it. Like, you're not a historian if you disagree with the official version of history and so on. The media is not a reflection of reality. In fact, I can give an example of that. When we were protesting at UCT at Curtis Skewer Hospital just after the attacks on Susan Fosler, I was part of it and I had to speak to the group. And I came home and my wife said, my phone's been ringing off the hook. What did you do? All of my friends asking, how could your husband be so mean, so cruel, so hard-hearted? And what did I say? Well, fortunately, we'd been filmed the whole time by Loving Life TV, so I could actually go back and see what was said. We didn't say a thing against the local hospitals and so on. And so we went on to ETV and SATV, and it was, you know, these protesters were protesting against the doctors and nurses of Curtis Skewer Hospital. You have some weeping nurse saying, it's so hard. We're risking our lives every day fighting COVID. And now these people are protesting against us. And I looked at what I'd said, looked at our posters. There wasn't one single accusation against the nurses and doctors. It was just support for Susan Fosloo. And, you know, that the media can distort something like that and turn our loving support of Susan Fosloo into a hate crime, just bizarre. But when you control opinion, as corporate America controls opinion in the United States, they own the media. Five men own all the media in America. And whether you're talking about NBC, CNN, the Clinton News Network, or BBC, the Bolshevik Broadcasting Corporation, or Newspeak, Useless News and World Report, Sly Magazine, well, you can make the masses believe almost anything you want and guide them as you please. And it's true. The amount of people that you meet, they believe what they get in the media. Now, you know that McDonald's produces junk food for your body. Well, garbage for your mind is produced by NBC, CNN, BBC. I should add the Cape Crimes, the Sunday Crimes, and all the garbage we get produced in South Africa too. And the SATV, Satanic Altar Television, BBC specializes in manufacturing disinformation. I used to think BBC was reliable. That was a long time ago. Did you notice that George Orwell, when he wrote 1984, he modeled it, he said he modeled Mini-Truth, the Ministry of Truth, on the BBC. He worked in the BBC during the Second World War. He was a propagandist. And so he modeled, and notice, he didn't sit 1984 in Moscow. It's not a crit on Stalin. He sat in London, and his key protagonist is Winston Smith. He's modeling it on the BBC in Britain, and he's basing it firmly in England because he had seen how propaganda works and where England was going. And now you can see George Orwell's 1984. now looks very prophetic. I think the British government are using it as a manual, not as a warning. Because now you've got thought crimes and you've got thought police. Whenever there's a big story in the media, look around for the story they're trying to distract you from. What's on the front page of the newspapers and the main headlines on the TV news is not the main story. That's a distraction. The entertainment industry is in many cases worse, if that was possible. Hollywood is anything but holy. It is a place of defilement. The scripture says, I will set no wicked thing before my eyes. And what is Hollywood giving us? Nudity, violence, blasphemy, idolatry, cursing. Even Christians now are swearing because they've picked it up from Hollywood. Hollywood's teaching generations to swear who never swore before. And of course, our religious institutions are being undermined. Just think of the Methodist Church. Well, I use the word church very loosely with inverted commas and italics and with a small c. The Methodist, what they're called in America, the United Methodist Church, they voted to adopt the entire LGBTQ agenda with no debate, dissenting voices, unanimous. That's LGBTQ ministers, LGBTQ bishops, LGBTQ marriages, the whole deal. No debate. Methodist Church is no longer a church. They're not even Methodist. What on earth would John Wesley or Charles Wesley say about those apostates running that organization? Absolutely disgraceful. And of course, our political institutions have been hijacked. Just think of the fact, if you go onto the South African Communist Party website, which I've done, you will see the SA Communist Party put before the last elections. The SA Communist Party are not placing any candidates in the next elections, but advise all cadres to vote for the ANC candidate. Now, if you go on the Communist Party USA website, which I've done, they've got there, along with the baseball caps, Lenin baseball caps for sale, Lenin t-shirts for sale and all this, Visa cards accepted, which, by the way, the Southern Communist Party does too. But aside from that hypocrisy, they say the Communist Party USA is not placing any candidates in the upcoming elections, 2024, but advise all cadres to vote for the Democratic Party candidate. What does that tell you? They've hijacked, taken over control over those parties. Like the Southern Communist Party has taken control of the ANC. Every single president of the ANC has been a senior member of the Politburo of the Southern Communist Party, including Nelson Mandela. Every one of them, without exception. Now, the slogan of Anthony Gramsci was capture the culture. And that's where the term cultural Marxism comes from. It comes from the Frankfurt School of Marxists. Subvert Christian civilization through obscenity, pornography, and blasphemy. Herbert Marcuse, another of the Frankfurt School Marxists, emphasized the importance of subverting the culture through obscenity, blasphemy, perversion, and pornography. He advocated use swear words as verbal grenades to attack the bourgeois Christian society. On the plays, in the arts, in music, and of course in films now. Obscenity and blasphemy are weapons in psychological warfare to break down Christian civilization. To such an extent, you now have ministers of the gospel using obscenities from the pulpit in some places. Famously, one of the, what was it, Mars Hill up in Oregon? Their pastor was literally showing elements of pornography on Sunday services and using all kinds of pornographic speech in the church. I mean, some people who are very kind said he's got a potty mouth. But I'm sorry to say this, people like that in the church, they're doing what Herbert Marcuse advised. Herbert Marcuse also spoke about repressive tolerance. The cultural Marxist Herbert Marcuse, in his 1965 paper called Repressive Tolerance, proposed setting up a victim coalition of people who could be convinced that they were being oppressed. And of course, who's being oppressed? Black people are being oppressed. Women are being oppressed. And not just the workers being oppressed as in Marxism, but now the LGBTQ guys are oppressed and the transgenders are being oppressed. And so they get a coalition of victims who are convinced they're being oppressed. And this cadre of people become the new proletariat to establish the long march to the institutions. Here's some of the oppressed kicking someone in the head. There's no better way to prove that you're oppressed than to get someone on the ground and kick them in the head. And the new oppressed would be brainwashed into thinking the oppressors are biblical Christians, the patriarchy, fundamental Christians, you know, The evangelicals, they are the problem. And the strategy casts Christians as narrow-minded bigots. Have you ever been called that? By nature, all Christians are racist, xenophobes, homophobes, Islamophobes, misogynists, and greedy. So, for example, I'm hearing from these characters screaming and ranting and raving about racism, and then I quoted Prince Mangosuthu Buthelezi. And then I was told by some idiot whitey in America, well, Mangosuthu Buthelezi is not black. What do you mean he's not black? He's descended from Shaka and Keshwayo. He's a Zulu of the Zulus. No, he's not black. Oh, so I start quoting from Robert Williams and who's the doctor in Trump's government who did heart transplants? Ben Carson. Ben Carson said this. Ben Carson's not black. You could fool me. Looks black to me. No? What about Bill Clinton? No, Bill Clinton's a black. Hillary Clinton's black. Biden's black. Do you remember what Biden said? If you don't vote for me, you're not black. And so on. So actually, you can have people as black as Mangosuthu Buthelezi, and he's not black because he's not communist, you see. But you can have a whitey like old Hillary or Bill Clinton, and they're black. Why? Because they are leftist communists. So the whole narrative has changed, the definition. I remember being at one of these rallies in Cape Town where they were shouting, the people shall govern. And I said, I'm one of the people too. And I thought, no, you're not one of the people. I'm not a person. What am I? And he said, no, you bourgeois. And so they keep changing definitions. The people shall govern means the party shall govern. Because when you get down to it, if you hear the people shall govern, you think that's us. No, by definition, you're not people. If you're not a member of the party, the Communist Party, you're not a person. That's the definition, by the way. And a black person who opposes communism is not black. Our friend Jonas Savimbi, fighting for the independence of Angola, I was told by some whiteys in America he's not black. Because Jonas Savimbi was fighting the communists, so that makes him not black. Moise Tshombe, who fought the communists in Congo, he's also not black, by the way, believe it or not. So this is the way it goes. In fact, now you can say, well, I'm a woman, and they'll tell you you're not a woman. Some man is a woman, but you're not a woman, right? And nobody can be a woman better than a man, because the Women of the Year awards has been given to men and pretending to be women in the last few years, because no one can be a better woman than a man can, apparently. And so this is the kind of mentality you're getting, and this is an advanced stage of psychological warfare. All this could be definitional of what it means to have white privilege. Now, I know all about white privilege. I was raised in white privilege. We were caned at school. We were conscripted to the army. We were beaten up by the corporals and so on. And then we were put in places where people wanted to throw metal into us. And then when I came out of the army, I had to work 6 days a week, 8 hours a night in the fire brigade to put myself through college, because I was too male and too pale under apartheid to go a bursary for college. So all the black and colored students at our college were on the bursaries, and it was my white privilege to work a full-time job 6 days a week, 8 hours a night to put myself through Baptist Theological College because I was too male and too pale for old apartheid South Africa. And then they called me the previously advantaged. And now I would say we were the previously disadvantaged and we were the presently disadvantaged. And that's white privilege. White privilege is you can get caned at school and conscript the army and beaten up in their way. And then they force you into a place where people want to kill you to protect the black Avambo people in Southwest Africa and Avamboland from red communists on the other side who are being supported and led by Cubans and by Russians and East Germans and some or another. That's a race war. Well, as far as I could see, it was black and white together against red. But they don't like that. They prefer... If you're white, by definition, you are an oppressor, you are a racist, you are a xenophobe, an Islamophobe, a misogynist, greedy. What's missing here is anti-Semite. You know, I'm sure we all are too. This new proletariat is taught the wonders of tolerance for everyone. You've got to be tolerant of everything from LGBTQ, rapists, perverts, whatever. But Christians, you can be totally intolerant with. So in his 1965 paper, Marcuse gave the justification for this new intolerance. Liberating tolerance would then mean intolerance against movements from the right and tolerance for movements from the left. There are no enemies to the left. Our enemies are all of the right. And I heard that even from F.W. de Klerk back in the early 90s. There's no enemies on the left. Our enemies are from the right. And what did Biden say? The greatest threat to the United States of America is white supremacy. Really? Well, how many buildings have they blown up? And so on. As to the scope of this tolerance and intolerance, it would extend to the stage of action as well as discussion and propaganda of deed as well as word. Toleration is a device used to introduce a new law system as a prelude to a new intolerance. Notice these people, I remember the left, censorship is evil, intrinsically evil. You can't have censorship. What they wanted is legalization of pornography. When pornography was all legalized, suddenly now they believe in censorship, but not censoring pornography. They believe in censoring any hate speech, thought crime, Christian gospel. That's what's got to be censored. So notice the people who used to oppose censorship now support censorship. Once they're in government, they want censorship for those who disagree with them. C.S. Lewis said, of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exiles for the good of its victim may be the most oppressive. It may be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent moral busybodies. Omnipotent moral busybodies. Isn't that so descriptive? The robber baron's cruelty may sometimes sleep. His cupidity may at some point be satiated. But those who torment us for our own good will torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their conscience. There's nothing worse than an omnipotent moral busybody. You know, like, think of the American government now, or the British government, cracking down on people who've got a different thought. This is for your own good. We're bashing your heads in. Just think, during the COVID cult, the Zimbabwe government came into churches, rifle butted the pastor in the face, dragged him by the hair in some cases, or ear, down the aisle, blood trails down the aisle, and then kicked him in the head outside the church. What more must the government do to show they care about your health? They don't want you to get COVID. You know, you can die from a bullet in the head maybe, but we're not going to let you die of COVID. Karl Marx declared, the first battlefield is a rewriting of history. This is where PSYOPs is carried out today. George Orwell said, the most effective way to destroy a people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history. And that's why the culture war is so key. Those who understand Marxism, particularly the cultural Marxism of the Frankfurt School, and the Gramsci strategy and the role of Obsentia and Marcuse's revolutionary strategy, will immediately recognize where the violence and the campaign to topple statues and monuments and spray paint Obscenities on the walls comes from. This is cultural Marxism. This is Psy War. It's Psy War, enemy forces. We are the enemy. The Cultural Revolution is what's inspired this. Straight out of Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution of 1960s and the public humiliation, shaming, apology scenes in China, that's exactly how Mao Zedong publicly shamed and sidelined, humiliated the traditional leaders in China's revolution. They dragged out the teachers and the Confucian priests, and they forced them to kneel, stick guns in their necks, and forced these people to apologize and stand with their heads bowed and so on, shaming them. And this is a culture where shame and honor is so important. And that's where the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions come from. And there's prophetic warnings. George Orwell warned us in 1984 of newspeak, thought crimes, and thought police. It looks like you've had a little bit too much to think. Support your local thought police. Closed minds stop thought crimes. In 1984, we learned of opponents being vaporized or made unpeople and disappearing down a memory hole, which is what Zuckerberg and Facebook have specialized in. You know, the truth will set you free, except on Facebook. That will get you banned, shadow banned, and disappear down a memory hole, unplatformed. I wrote this book, Character Assassins, Dealing with Ecclesiastical Tyrants and Terrorists, showing how PSYOPs works within a church. And Aldous Huxley warned us in his prophetic book, Brave New World, of a future sophisticated society where people are distracted by endless entertainment stimulation and subdued by drugs to be easily manipulated by a new world order state. John Dewey was one of the authors of the Humanist Manifesto of 1933. You've heard of the Dewey Decimal System that organizes how many libraries? Well, he was a pioneer of state education in America, and he's a signatory of the Humanist Manifesto. And he's a pioneer of the humanist state indoctrination gulags that they have in America today. We should be able to recognize how much of the entertainment industry is defiling us and degrading us, especially when you see how many productions start with a Weinstein production. And Harvey Weinstein was, of course, a sexual predator, a rapist, evil, wicked man. And why are we surprised? That's the kind of films he produced. How much of the news media discourages and distracts us? You often just feel so negative after reading the newspaper. I mean, that's why I think it's good to spare ourselves the grief. Much better to surround ourselves with songs of praise and battle hymns of the church, and then to turn on the news and listen to what they want to say. And so much in our society today, including the music and arts, depresses and disgraces us. How much better than going to these sort of rock concerts, which now you can get in the church, to Handel's Messiah or to hear some uplifting concert. There's so much that's good and beautiful in the world. We don't need to go for this ugliness. And then you get the Stockholm Syndrome, where the hostage takes on the case of the kidnappers. Now, I'm sorry to say, this is a church I've spoken in, and the pastor is a friend of mine who's even been at some of our camps and courses. When the BLM started, he tagged me on social media, you know, to repeat the Black Lives Matter, and I responded with All Lives Matter, and I got such an overflow of hate from so many people. How can you say it? You know, how racist to say All Lives Matter. And then friends of ours in America started Black Babies Lives Matter, because the most aborted people in the world are black babies. In fact, you've got more chance of being aborted than being born if you're an American black baby. They are being aborted at a rate of 1 in 2, or more than 1 in 2, actually. You're more likely to get aborted than born if you're a black American today. So here I had this friend who got his church leaders lined up there with I Can't Breathe and Black Lives Matter signs, and I called him out that this is a dangerous new cult, and it's like a new religion. This is dangerous. Why would you do it? It's all politicized. It's got a political agenda. And what about all Black Lives Matter? That's also racist, by the way, because most blacks in America are killed violently by black gangsters, and so, or abortionists in this case. And so if you even say all Black Lives Matter, that's considered racist. And if you say all black babies' lives matter, that's also racist. You say all lives matter, that's racist. So what agenda is this? Cultural Marxism has deteriorated society. Critical race theory has divided society. Confuse, divide, and conquer. And, you know, I think it's so important to recognize how we're living in a brainwashed society. When you see so many white people are part of Black Lives Matter, in fact, I think they're running the whole thing. When white people are protesting against white people for being white people, I was at an evangelistic, or I should say an evangelical conference, and I was accused of being a WASP. I was one of the contributors there. So I said, you're a WASP. And I said, can you define that? I'm not familiar with that term. It's back in the 80s. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant. So at the time I said, well, the fact that I'm white and Anglo-Saxon is entirely due to God. And I've got no problem the way God's made any of us. I used to think that being a Protestant was my choice, but since I've come to understand the doctrines of the Reformation, that's also God's doing. So if you want to call me a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, take this up with God. That's how he made me. And pathetic. Most of Hollywood entertainment degenerates and degrades. And you might have seen the sign in the agenda movie. The Gramsci strategy, the Termite strategy, is corrupted and rotted. Most of the institutions of the West, and the classic example is the Democratic Party of today, which has got all these evil Marxist influences in it. And the Democratic Party in America today have reached a stage where they actually booed God. When someone was wanting God to be on the platform, the whole assembly of the DNC booed. So Democratic Party literally have come to a stage of being anti-Christ and anti-God. The Marcusians Subvert and Corrupt the Culture campaign has been very successful. Not only is perversion tolerated, perversion is now promoted and celebrated, and you're not even allowed to speak against it, or you're racist. Degenerate entertainment, defiled art, decadent culture are part of the strategy of cultural Marxists. They're aiming to corrupt and conquer or rot the soul of the nation. We're seeing communism in the classroom and a war on historic monuments in the streets. Discouragement, distraction, depression, dependency, deterioration, division, degeneration, degradation, disintegration, all equal defeat, and ultimately death. So how can we resist Marxist bullying tactics? Resistance is respected. Weakness is despised. Now, I've seen this over and over. There's nothing communists respect more than strength. There's nothing they despise more than weakness. Just look at the BLM riots, attacking cars, burning vehicles. All of this, the police standing back. BLM was designed to whip people up, and all over the world you've got violence against police and and police getting firebombs thrown on them. And then you've got these idiots washing feet. Those people who think they can calm the situation by bowing to the mob, washing their feet, brushing or kissing their boots, literally, like these idiotic policemen in New York, or these people standing on and kneeling on their flag. Not only figuratively, but literally, they have no idea that they, all they're doing is actually aggravating the situation. They're encouraging revolutionaries to demand far, far more. Raise the clenched fist, wear the mask, bow the knee. Like this foolish Swedish policewoman kneeling down, white silence is violence. Silence is violence. Remember all that? Raising a clenched fist. This policewoman should have been charged. I mean, what treason in a time of war to support your enemy? And of course, Nancy Pelosi led the US Congress in bowing the knee as part of the BLM movement with their masks. In my experience, it's absolutely essential. You never give Marxist bullies or mobs a millimeter. If you give them an inch, they will take a mile. You give them a finger, they'll take your arm. Being brought up in war-torn Rhodesia and experiencing terrorism and revolution in communist Angola and Mozambique, and being imprisoned in Zambia and Mozambique, so many cases I've seen, the more steadfastly and strongly you stand and resist, the better. The moment the Marxists sense weakness, fear, or compromise, they will smell blood and they'll not only howl for more, they will escalate the unreasonable demands. And one example is Colonel Breitmark, who we showed in our tribute to him, how he stood up and preached the gospel to the communists in Angola, a man who had beaten them in battle. And there's Colonel Breitmark, who led the Eagle Strike Battle of Kasinga on the terrorist headquarters of SWAPO inside Angola, way behind enemy lines, who went into Angola during the Civil War and recruited thousands of black Portuguese-speaking Angolans to come over and fight for the South African Army. We've got a 3-2 Battalion Beret in here, just reminding of Colonel Breitmark, who wrote the books Forge and Battle, They Live by the Sword, Buffalo Soldiers, who led and founded, trained South Africa's elite fighting unit and elite infantry unit, who did, I think, more enemy kills than any other infantry unit or all other infantry units combined. They were the elite infantry units in South Africa. 3-2 Battalion, made up of Angolan, black, Portuguese-speaking recruits who came like South Africa's Foreign Legion. And they were phenomenal. Eddie Fulion and the 3-2 Battalion people. Well, Colonel Breitmark, when he left the army, joined Frontline Fellowship, trained our people. We went into Angola, we ministered to our people, and then we went and we preached to the communists themselves. Colonel Breitmark was able to say to the Cubans, I'm Colonel Jan Breitmark of 3-2 Battalion. My men and I, we killed thousands of you. Thousands. We never had any trouble killing you. Our problem was catching you. You ran so fast. You broke Olympic records running away from the battle, even when you outnumbered us 10 to 1. And Colonel Breitmark challenged these characters in Angola your God is Karl Marx. Your religion is atheism. Your commissars are the priests of Satan. You're damned. You're lost. You're doomed. You're going to burn in hell forever. If you knew what was waiting for you 1 second on the other side of the grave, you'd crawl across the minefield and beg 3-2 Battalion to show you the way of salvation in Jesus Christ. And he told 3-2 Battalion to live in the sight of the heathen, that they will seek Christ and to minister with him. Well, when I marched 30,000 people to Parliament in Cape Town to protest Mandela's secular state policies, I was summoned to the president's mansion. We'd marched under Grondwet op Kortsevet, back to the Bible. And Mandela's aide came to Parliament and summoned me to come to the president's mansion. We marched on Tuesday. On Thursday, we were at Grootegeluk State. And the first words Mandela said to me was, so, Mr. Hammond, what were you doing during the years of struggle? I said, I was fighting people like you, sir. And he laughed and he smiled and he stood up and he shook my hand and he said, I'm so glad to meet an honest white man. All the other whites I've met told me how they always opposed apartheid and they actually supported me. I wondered how the National Party had stayed in power for 44 years when all the while whites actually opposed the National Party and supported me. And my response was, well, make no mistake, Mr. President, we were not fighting for apartheid, we were fighting against communism and against terrorism. His response was, apartheid is the greatest evil in the history of the world. To which I had to respond, I cannot agree, Mr. President. That prize must go to your friends and supporters, the communists. And he had just recently had Fidel Castro, the longest reigning dictator in the 20th century, in Cape Town, gave him the biggest medal South Africa's got to give. had him speak to joint sitting of parliaments and the National Congress of provinces. And Fidel Castro, you know, mass murdering thug who turned a desert, turned an absolute oasis in the Caribbean into a communist hellhole where people by the millions fled across shark-infested waters to escape. And then I pointed out how in the 20th century, 160 million people have been killed, not by foreign governments, but by their own governments, secular governments, communist governments. Not in warfare, but in peacetime, killed by their own governments. 160 million. And pointed out what was documented in the Black Book of Communism and Death by Government, killed by their own governments in times of peace, including 66 million slaughtered under communism in the Soviet Union. And then, of course, more, 68 million killed under communist China. And the exchange went on, and at no point did I give him an inch. I brought out the facts, the testimonies, the catalogue of his friends, communists. And incredibly, he sat there listening to all of this, probably somewhat stunned with the facts. But he then told me, he sort of leant back and he stared at the scene and said, when the Boers had me imprisoned on Robben Island, they wouldn't let me wear sunglasses. And I couldn't wear long trousers, I was forced to wear short trousers. Well, this is a picture you see at Gateway to Robben Island at the waterfront of Nelson Mandela with his sunglasses, leaning on his spade for his personal garden and wearing long trousers. So that refutes what he said, but I'm assuming he's talking about early on Robben Island, maybe in the first year or so they wouldn't let him wear sunglasses. But he certainly did somewhere later along, at least his hagiography documentation at the Mandela cell and so on shows that. So I said, Mr. President, my eyes are also very sensitive and I can imagine how unpleasant and uncomfortable that must have been. But I'm sure you'll agree with me that hardly compares with atrocities documented by Alexander Solzhenitsyn in the Gulag Archipelago. And he, of course, was trained by people like Che Guevara and the Cuban secret police, and he was guilty of a whole lot of atrocities, of bombings and so on. Well, at one point, Nelson Mandela expressed his surprise that we were wanting to restrict the rights of women by opposing abortion. And I responded, Mr. President, you are questioning the Christianity of people who, over 40 years ago, justified apartheid. I tell you, sir, it will not be 40 years from now. People will question your humanity for legalizing abortion. You are seeking to replace apartheid with abortion. And abortion is worse than apartheid. Abortion does not just place a baby on a separate voter's roll and restrict where they can live or swim. Abortion takes a baby's life. Life begins at conception. Abortion is the violent taking of that life. And abortion is the worst kind of apartheid, for it separates a baby from its own mother and from its life support system. At its most crucial stage of development, you are seeking to replace discrimination on the basis of race with discrimination on the basis of age. And at the end of the hour, Mandela stood up and told us, you may now take your pictures. Now, we didn't mean to be rude, but I hadn't thought about pictures. I mean, what would I do with a picture of me and Mandela? So I said, no, thank you. And he turned with his mouth agape like his jaw hit the floor in apparent shock. We might have been the first delegation to meet him. We weren't interested in getting their pictures taken with him. And then I hastened to add, but sir, we would like to pray for you. And no, no, he said, that's very private and personal. So I pretended not to hear him. I placed a hand on one shoulder, and Dumini Zunzevenster placed a hand on the other shoulder, and we prayed for Mandela. We prayed that the Lord would not grant Mr. Mandela one moment's peace until he did what he knew what was right, introduced legislation to protect helpless, innocent babies from the violence and injustice of abortion. And then I prayed that Mandela would find peace in Christ by bowing the knee and surrendering to Almighty God to do his will. And after impassioned prayer, I took a book from James Kendi, which I thought would be best suited to reach him. And Mandela thanked us and assured us he is always responsive to the concerns of our constituency and his door is always open. And the next week, Monday morning, senior investigators of the Revenue Service knocked on our doors and began a 7-year audit on our mission and family, going back 6 years and carrying on for another 7 years, so 13 years in total. On another occasion, 1995, I was summoned to Parliament to give a submission to one of their subcommittees on their draft publications bill, which effectively came to legalize pornography and blasphemy. Now, after I gave my submission, which was held in the old House of Assembly, same part where Henry Cavett was stabbed to death. During question time, one ANC MP asked me, have you ever apologized for what you did in the SADF? So I said, do you want me to apologize for what I did in the South African Defense Force? And he said, yes. I said, I'm sorry, we did not kill all of you. You were not freedom fighters. You were terrorists. You didn't attack military bases. You attacked civilians, black civilians. You burned over 1,000 black South Africans with a brutal necklace murder. You planted landmines and dirt roads. You killed whole families. You planted landmines and roads leading to schools. You killed school children coming in school buses on the way to school. This used to be a combi. Just imagine what it did to the people if it did this to the metal. You kidnapped young children from schools. You took them across the border to brutalize them and train them for your terrorist groups. You murdered many. You raped the girls. You threw hand grenades through the windows into black policemen's homes at night. You petrol bombed the homes of black town councillors, car bombs, limpet mines, blatant targeting civilians. You are hypocrites. I mean, just think of the Church Street bombings. And we used to have these signs all around our shopping centres reminding us of Soviet origin weapons or Red Chinese weapons, which the ANC were using in our public centres. All of this well documented in the history of communism in South Africa. I said, you speak against racism, but you laugh and applaud and give standing ovations to the worst racist on the planet today, Robert Mugabe, dictator of Zimbabwe. And they did. They cheered him. He was treated as with such honor when he came to conference in Natal, in Durban. And you think of Mugabe's thugs standing with their boots on people's necks, beating them, whipping them in the main road, which is now called Samora Machel Avenue, and beating women praying outside a government building, choking and dragging people through. You know, talk about George Floyd. Well, what about, you know, do Black Lives Matter in Zimbabwe? Apparently not to the Americans, that's for sure. You have no right to ever speak against racism when you so obviously applaud, endorse, and enthusiastically practice it. I'm sorry we ended the war before thoroughly and completely eradicating all of you communists. Well, you can imagine it was a pretty stunned and awkward silence for a time. But then the chairman just said, right, let us move to our next subject. And they never brought up the subject again. Now, that's the only way you can deal with Marxists, guilt manipulators, gaslighters, thugs, and terrorists. They respect strength, they despise weakness. Now, I think there's a lot more one can say on the subject. Let me stop there. Are there any questions, comments, complaints, criticisms, guilt manipulation, cyber war?
Seeing the level of control and pre-planning, I'm just wondering now if they didn't do a phenomenal judo move on us South Africans. From 70s to 1989, fighting this incredible war, sucking out this enormous amount of energy. I mean, they could have just had the helicopter gunships going to the Rivonia trials and saved a lot of misery. You know, right there, I know it's very controversial, but I mean, killing communists over the border, but they're festering in their own country. And well, look at the misery that they've brought.
Well, after the Rivonia trial, even the Star, which was a pretty communist newspaper in Joburg, praised the judgment of life imprisonment on Mandela, because everyone expected him to get the death penalty. Mm. If he had done those same crimes in Britain, he would have been hung. If he'd done those same crimes in France at that time, they would have guillotined him. If he'd done those same crimes in America, they would have electrocuted him. At that time, so 1964, whenever the Rivonia trial judgment came out, he would have been executed anywhere in the world for those same crimes. And the liberals and the Marxists were praising this judge, who was, of course, a liberal judge, an English judge at that, for this very enlightened judgment. Nobody thought this was unfair to sentence Mandela to life imprisonment, because what he had done, you know, for example, you just take the Johannesburg bombing, where a grandmother and a granddaughter were incinerated by a petrol bomb in a suitcase under the bench they were sitting in Johannesburg railway station. Hideous. I mean, over 160 different acts of public violence and terrorism he pleaded guilty to. He is legally trained, so he knew what guilty meant.
The energy of the country, because you're taking the youngsters. I mean, some of these guys are so tough. They were tough even before they were soldiers. Those terrorists didn't have a chance already. You know, yep. Our country's got a lot of strong, hardcore men, and you've just
had
all this energy for a good long time, for 10, 15 years.
I think more like 26 years.
You've got battle for anybody. You don't want to know about communists in your own country, never mind over the borders and stuff. So either way, if it was deliberate or if it was accidental, it worked against us because a lot of the energy that would have come against these communists was diverted. And I'm just looking at it, I don't know what I'm talking about. But it, I might not know.
I think you're onto something, but let's apply it to something more recent. Britain put so much energy into the Second World War. For what? To betray Poland, who they said was the reason they went in, and to betray the whole of Eastern Europe into communism, to enable the Soviets to take the whole of Central and Eastern Europe. And now that Britain's under threat, where they've got thousands of invaders coming to Britain every day, what's the Royal Navy doing to protect them? The British fought Germany for no good reason, both the First and Second World War, and now they are nationally exhausted, and now they can't even defend themselves from rioters in the streets stabbing their girls. I mean, what would Richard the Lionheart or the Crusaders have done, or the Saxons of the past, if people came and started to rape and stab their women and their children? The British of today are battle fatigued from, they bankrupted the empire and they squandered hundreds of thousands of lives in the First and Second World War fighting against their cousins in Germany. For what? To support the Serb terrorist sponsors who had murdered Archduke Franz Ferdinand? And then to protect Poland, who they betrayed at the end anyway. I mean, what did they go to war for? And that's why so many veterans in Britain today say, if we could have seen what would happen to Britain since, we wouldn't have fought as we did in the Second World War. My own dad said, I can't believe we wasted our time fighting the French twice, fighting for the French twice.
Is it possible that it's a similar scenario to South Africa, or is it completely different?
I'd say it's more aggravated in Britain. South Africa, I think we had a valid reason to fight on our borders. It was a justifiable war, but we neglected and we lost the patience and energy for the internal conflict. And the reason is the psyops in our universities and our schools and our newspapers. The newspapers were every day thoroughly debilitating and degrading and discouraging. And Cape Town was probably the worst of the whole lot in the country. Our newspapers are some of the worst. And just the rag shows. I remember coming in 1977, seeing the rag show down Adderley Street, and we went to his family, and, you know, he had all these stupid UCT students, drunk as hell, men dressed as women. I mean, just it was bizarre. You had this whole transvestitism, the blasphemy, the stupidity, the absolute drag queen mentality of these rags. So this is where we meant to send our children for university, you know, a university where every year they would degrade themselves to these stupid rag shows, and they were thick as anything. Nothing about academics, nothing that would make you respect these people. And that was Cape Town, Adderley Street. The rag show processions, just pathetic. There wasn't anything redeeming, nothing interesting, nothing clever. It was just stupid. You know, seeing big hairy men dressing themselves in bikinis and lingeries and looking like imbeciles. We have them sometimes at the traffic lights here, trying to sell their magazines, rag magazines. I wouldn't give a half a cent to UCT rags or anything. A bunch of blaspheming, drunken pagans. Scum. I'd never think of sending my children to a degrading institution like that. And they've got the most beautiful building and campus on the planet. I don't think any country has got a university on such a beautiful campus with such a lovely view. And yet what's taught there is just degrading garbage.
Same can be said, or similar for Robben Island. I mean, you've got such a asset, actually, to the Western Cape. You have an island so close offshore, and then they go...
It should be a holiday resort.
...a stupid prison on it, and now make it some idiotic memorial to a horror.
That's a site of pilgrimage now.
No, why don't they go and take that cell and put it in somewhere where they can go and worship it every day if they want, and...
Yeah. Oh, I think it's a tropical paradise. If I had to be locked up anywhere, Robben Island is the place I'd choose. They could walk around this island, which is all kinds of nature, all day. They only have to be in their prison cells at night. There's no nicer environment for prison than there. Just think of the Gulag archipelagos in the Soviet Union as a comparison. This is about as pleasant as it gets. But most people around the world now think it's one of the worst horror houses on the planet. You know, it's not like the French Devil Island, where they sent innocent people. What the French did, and you read about Devil's Island, I mean, that was horrific, how the French took their people. And in France, you weren't innocent till proven guilty. By the French law, you were guilty till proven innocent. And so the burden of proof was on the accused, not on the state. And many of the people end up on Devil Island in South America were innocent people. But yeah, I'm digressing. Frank.
Christian, 61, when you changed from a commonwealth to a republic.
Yes.
If we didn't do that and we started with the commonwealth, would we be worse off than the Brits now? Or would we be in a better situation?
I think it could have been worse because staying in the Commonwealth, it was the Commonwealth. They weren't actually, you know, we had fought for Britain in the First and Second World War and in Malaya and Korea. It didn't help us one bit. It was not one for all for one. This wasn't the Musketeers here. We could do anything for Britain, but they had already betrayed us. Churchill had already agreed with Franklin Delano Roosevelt to abandon the empire. They bankrupted the empire, gave all the assets to America. America's main foreign policy goal was to dismantle the British Empire and the French Empire too. So I think if we stayed the Commonwealth, it would have just undermined us more. It was better to get out. I think Favut was right on that point. We needed to unite the country, and pulling out the Commonwealth and becoming a republic was much more therapeutic. I think the unity in this country improved from that point. Because we had divided loyalties with the British Crown and the Commonwealth before that. So the 91 pulling out, I'm glad that I'm almost one of those born frees in the sense that I was a part of the Republic in my upbringing. Well, of course, mostly in Rhodesia, but still. Rhodesia's independence from Britain was also considered very
controversial.
A very controversial time. My father supported Rhodesia becoming independent, but he personally thought we should have remained a constitutional monarchy. My dad was quite a royalist, and I do feel that Ian Smith was right. He had a tough choice, but I think he made the right choice. He had fought for Britain all 6 years in the Rhodesian Royal Air Force. But nevertheless, Britain was betraying us. They were treacherous. We had to break away. Now Britain's betraying their own people, and you can't miss it anymore. I mean, well, JP, you've worked in London. How do you feel?
Well, London's not British anymore. And the whole of England's not English.
It looks more Arab these days.
On Ireland now too, and they're working on all the places that were untouched. They're catching up fast. They've been totally invaded, and it's amazing that they tolerate it.
I'm sorry to say, quite a few of my Rhodesian friends say they think, you know, good, Britain's getting what they deserve. They betrayed us, now they're betraying themselves. And I can't feel like that because I feel, even though Britain betrayed us, Britain was used to civilize and evangelize the world. And it's been, not only to have great museums and wonderful cathedrals, but there's some great Christian heritage. I'm sorry to see a country that was once a bastion of Christianity be paganized and wrecked and secularized. So I don't feel any of that sense of, well, they deserve a tit for tat. They betrayed us. They are going down. This is God's judgment. I don't want to see Britain go down.
The problem is it's our heritage too.
It is.
I mean, if you're English speaking, and if you're from Europe, anywhere in Europe, Holland also, they're more liberal than the British. They're unbelievable. They're on another level.
Yeah, no. But the Netherlands, I also felt the Dutch were very apostate, but I had one of my best camps ever in the Reformation 500. 2017, I was at a camp of Reformation Revival where we had 960 people in a camp there, and a lot of prayer, a lot of Bible study and hymn singing. And I said, I'd never thought there were this many Christians in the whole of the Netherlands. And they said, no, but you're in the Bible Belt here. I didn't know Netherlands has a Bible Belt. Okay, Amsterdam is a drug cesspool. But there are parts of the Netherlands that still have dedicated Christians. And again, you go to Britain, and you find a few places where there's pockets of strong Christians, but it's just a few spots. And you know, these magnificent churches, wonderful museums, great heritage and history, but they've got such an evil government, and they've got such a wicked government, and the population is so secularized. It's sad, but I don't want to give up any part of Europe or any part of the world to paganism. I want to see revival in each of these countries. But Psy War is how they've won. Basically speaking, the communists are not good soldiers. They don't win their battles very well. They lose the battles, but they win the wars because they depend on treachery and cy war. I mean, ANC didn't win a single battle. They didn't win a skirmish. But they got the country how? By psychological warfare, by subversion, by treachery. And I believe that's what's going to happen soon in Britain. Britain may not have lost the battles, but they have lost the war. And at the moment, they're being betrayed. But remember, some of the principles of Cywar can be used for good. We can take these same principles, education, entertainment, news media, religious institutions, political institutions, infiltrate them with the gospel, evangelize, and seek to redeem. So a lot of the media that they've used against us, we can use that media to promote the gospel. I got the vision while I was in the army that they're coming to us with hate and landmines and Marxism and terrorism. Have we ever gone to them with the gospel? And so the best form of defense is attack. So we've gone into communist countries like Mozambique and Angola and undermined them. And we supported their guerrillas, the UNITA Freedom Fighters in Angola, the RENAMO in Mozambique, SPLA in Sudan. And we've seen communist countries subverted. We worked for the subversion of the communists in Eastern Europe, Bible smuggling, Christian radio programs, publishing from outside, exposing the atrocities from inside, evangelizing and discipling the people. And ultimately, we saw the Berlin Wall collapse, the Iron Curtain collapse. So we can use these tactics of Cywar against the enemy too, and for the gospel, for fulfilling the Great Commission. So I don't believe we should give up. We should just turn the tables on him, literally turn the tables, and give them what they hate. They subverted us with communism. We're going to subvert them with the gospel. And we succeeded in quite a few places. So when I think of the changes in Zambia, Mozambique, which is more open for the gospel than we are, where it's easier to start a Christian school in Mozambique than it is in South Africa. Virtually no paperwork. When you think of the changes in Zambia from a communist country to being a pro-Christian country, there's so much that we can be grateful for.
So, in the Bible, is spirit and spiritual the same as psychological? Is it not after the word?
Psy even is the study of the soul. Psychology is the study of the soul. Now, I know psychology has become a total pagan cesspool, mainly because of Freud and so on. But there's nothing wrong with the psyche. Taking the Greek word for psychology, for the soul. So psychology, you can also take it as psychological or spiritual study. And so psychological warfare, the battle for the soul. And we speak about how they rotted the soul of the nation. Well, we can revive the soul of the nation. Now, let me go to a couple of upcoming events and notices over here. So we've got here available our frontline news on the top of the table. Okay, what's going on there? And I want to speak about just a few notices about some things that are upcoming. What's happened with this? Okay. So we've got on the front line, Agenda 2, Master of Deceit, is an excellent DVD that exposes how these people operate, how the Marxists seek to take nations through psychological warfare. My book, Character Assassins, which I wrote with 8 other people, is a compendium exposing how Cywar works within the church, trying to bring down those people who are making a stand against the enemy. Security and Survival Handbook is super important for the physical, how to defend ourselves, how to reclaim our campuses for Christ, this is how to wage psychological warfare against the enemy on our campuses. A lot of resources that we can use here. Knowing our history, I must say, Stephen Mitford Goodson's books are so important, like Understanding the History of Favut or Smuts, and Smuts started our Reserve Bank. Bulala, Sketches from South African History. Christian Liberty Books downstairs got lots of great resources for fighting cultural war. Next week, Saturday, the 7th of September, we have an effective literature evangelism workshop right here from 9 in the morning, although we'll start serving tea and coffee from 8:30 to lunch. And those who want can join us after lunch for an outreach. We'll do some outreaches in the area, and we've got great resources. Then, Sunday, the 6th of October, not that far ahead, we'll be having Life Change Sunday. And then on the 16th of October, we're having a Reformation History a workshop right here as well, and that'll be in the morning of the Wednesday the 16th. On the 10th of November, we'll be having International Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. And I might say we've got here today the first of the Jesus Messiah or Jesus Messiah, Jesus Messias, the Jesus Messiah books in Afrikaans, full color, all cartoon format, 66 pages, an excellent evangelistic and discipleship tool. We're trying to get these to as many school children. I mean, this is cyber war as well, a wage against secularism in the schools. Let's get these distributed to schools. What we need is people who've got contacts with schools, organized for an assembly, and we can present the gospel and hand these free. These are valuable, expensive, well-printed, full-color products. The school children will be thrilled. It's in Afrikaans, which is the main language of the Western Cape. There's great need for Afrikaans gospel literature. So if you can find a way to get Afrikaans schools open for assemblies, we're having the Dutch missionary who's been responsible for this project, Leo Bon. He's coming on Sunday, so he'll be available all next week to go to schools and speak to them, present this. A very tall Dutchman. He'll have the kids kind of quite intrigued just at his height and size. But we're trying to organize as many meetings as possible. Frank's the one to speak to, and can write to frank@frontline.org.za or phone him. He'll give you contact details at the end. We have a very few in English, but we have lots in Afrikaans. When I say lots, I mean 50,000, 10 tons, 13 pallets. So see if you can help us with distribution. If you can just take one or two, that's fine. I've left some there if you want to give this as a friend who you know will benefit from this. So we've got a few on the table, and if you need more, Frank will give you packs. And if you can organize meetings, then we can give boxes. If you can get some pictures of people, this, we want to thank the people in the Netherlands who paid for this. This isn't something we've had to pay for, thankfully, because we don't have the money. But 50,000 printed. What a privilege. This will open doors, sow seeds, make contacts. But I found in the army and the fire brigade, every man will read every comic. You bring a comic in, like Czech publications, everybody will read them. Comics are compulsive. When people start to read these things, everyone else will read them too. So one of these will reach quite a few people if we distribute them wisely. Any other questions or comments before we conclude? So people who want to join us for the evangelism seminar next Saturday the 7th, that'll also be a good time for us to recruit more people who can help with the distributions. We'll need more people to help with distributions in schools, but we'd ask you to join the Literature Evangelism Workshop next Saturday the 7th. We're going to have Anthony deal with personal evangelism, Vaughan's going to deal with digital evangelism, I'm going to deal with film and literature evangelism, and we'll supply people what they need afterwards. And then we'll even go on the streets, and I hope we'll be able to go to Red Cross Hospital, some teams, and distribute some of these to the children in the hospitals, which is a wonderful opportunity, and it's very close by.